The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
From Hollywood, California, by way of the Broken Skull Ranch, this is the Steve Austin Show.
Give me a hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
Now, here's Steve Austin.
I'm sitting here talking to Marcus Alexander Bagwell. You may know him as Buff Bagwell, Buff the Stuff. Jesus H. Christ on a popsicle stick. He's been bearing with me. I've been working on sound problems for 45 minutes, trying to hit the record button on this goddamn Skype machine. I told Buff, I said, hell, if there can be a problem, there will be a problem. He's experienced what happens when the one-man clusterfuck tries to take over a goddamn Mac computer. Marcus, sorry about all the cussing. I'm a little bit in a discombobulated state due to all the technical difficulties, but nonetheless, it's good to be talking to your ass. How are you doing?
Dude, I am doing so great, Steve. First of all, let me say, you know, thank you so much, and just to be part of the show, and my God, I mean, people have got no idea. We could talk for days and weeks on end, and there's no way to possibly explain to anybody, smart marks, fans, any sort, and possibly explain to them the career we've had with each other. So it's just a lot of fun to be here, and thanks for having me.
Well, you know, a lot of things we're going to talk about. And, dude, you know, anytime I talk to somebody, I do all my research. I do my due diligence, do the best I can to represent a guy's career. But then I started thinking about breaking down our conversation. I said, you know what, I think it's going to be just like one of those days at Center Stage over in Savannah, Georgia, or BFE, Georgia, wherever. And I think we're just going to call this sumbitch in a ring if you're down with that.
And that's exactly the way we did it that night. We talked a little bit to catch up, and it was such a great feeling just to touch base a little bit to set this up. And you said, oh, we'll call it. You text me. You said, we'll call it in the ring, kid. And I text you back. I said, I'd give anything just to wrestle one more time with nothing hurts. Just one more time, brother, with nothing hurts.
But let's go ahead and put this out there that, you know, one of the reasons we are talking, you just come out with like a documentary or a docu-shoot, I think, as you've described it. It's called Buff Bagwell, the good, the bad, and the buff. It's the Mark Bagwell journey. And, you know, in this kind of this write-up that I'm looking at on my computer screen, you know, I didn't know that you were able to capture some 40 years of your life growing up. As we speak right now, you're 45. Was y'all's family one of those families that always recorded stuff? Because that's a lot of memories.
We actually were, Steve. My mother was the kind of mother that literally, I mean, it was just Christmas morning, the cameras were down there, and my brothers were cussing her, and they're thinking, get the cameras out of our face. And of course, I'm right in front of every camera shot there could be, and and doing my thing, having a blast, opening presents. They're bitching and griping, and I was lucky enough to come from a very wealthy family, and we had Christmas gifts and, you know, Corvettes outside and Jeeps and stuff. And here we are, my brothers are bitching about my mom taking some photographs. Well, my mother literally take that and go beyond belief back in the 80s. And I've got photo albums that are numbered 1 through 20 from my childhood picture up. And then somewhere along the line there, and I'll tell you exactly when, in 1986, I got really hooked on doing videos of my life. I just thought it was kind of cool. So we started doing video cameras, and it was kind of the new wave. And man, I taped shit that you would not believe on camera. And so my mom did it when we were young, so we got a lot of things when we were young. But yes, to answer your question, we were one of those families, and we just got a lot of footage on tape, and it was a lot of fun.
So going back to your professional wrestling career, you've never been you were wrestled as a stranger back in the day, but you're no stranger to the handsome stranger, I might add. But so you're no stranger to being kind of a ham for the camera. I mean, that was something that you kind of gravitated towards because you were always a guy that was very comfortable being on camera.
Absolutely, Steve. When my friends first heard that Mark Bagwell was going to be a wrestler, not one of them didn't answer, oh my God, that's perfect. You know, so, you know, here's the wild ass prima donna, where, you know, put me in front of the camera, and then all of a sudden it's my job. Everybody went, oh my God, that'll be perfect. So yes, to answer your question, it was right up my alley.
But dude, tell me about this wealthy upbringing, because I always thought you know, maybe it was middle class. Y'all had a little bit of dough. Were y'all loaded? I mean, did y'all own a lumber company? What's the story there?
We were loaded, Steve. My parents were fortunate enough that they opened a lumber company in the early 70s. And we're talking, I mean, even the numbers would be, we probably made gross $1 million a month would be our gross back in the 70s and 80s. And it supported our entire families and our entire family to the two brothers, and the brothers had houses, and we were what you consider definitely rich. And in Marietta, that was, you know, rich as could be. And then when the company in 1988, you know, the boys were going to work for Southeastern Building Supply was the name of the company, and it was a lumber yard. And in 1988, the year I graduated is the year that we had trouble and the economy was bad. And from that point on, the youngest didn't have a job and was going to figure out something to do. So it went real quick from having a job and all three of us were good to all of a sudden, what are we going to do now?
So did it go from riches to rags? Were y'all able to salvage anything?
Actually, what happened, Steve, is, you know, my mom was such a go-getter, Steve. We actually said, hey, you know what? My mom talked my dad into, you know, giving it one more go. And my dad was like, baby doll, let's just turn the key on it. It's over. My dad was the brains. My mom was the brawn. And he was like, just turn the key, be done with it. And he talked her, you know, she talked him back into doing it one more time and making a save out of it. And it just basically took everything with it. It took the house under, everything else was paid for under. I mean, I grew up in a $500,000 home with a swimming pool and our own weight room and a tanning bed before anybody even knew what a tanning bed was. We had a tanning bed at our house. So we definitely grew up in that time frame of craziness that we had things nobody else had, like saunas and steams, and way before people had that kind of shit in their house.
So what kind of a kid were you growing up, man? Were you spoiled rotten? Were you privileged but respectful? Describe yourself as a kid growing up.
I think what you said says it the best. I was extremely spoiled, but, buddy, extremely, you know, thankful and knew what I had and knew that I took care of my motorcycle or I got my ass whipped. I knew I took care of my Jeep and changed the oil in there or got my ass whipped. I mean, I remember days, Steve, that if I didn't crank my Jeep and let it warm up 5 minutes, my father would come out of the back and whip my ass right there, you know. And back then, Steve, this is going old school, but there was a catalytic converter. If you remember,
yes.
you let it warm up and you hit it one time and the engine would calm down. Well, if you didn't do that and go through the full fledge of it warming up and hit that gas one time and let the catalytic converter calm down, here come my dad out of the back.
Why was he such a stickler about you warming up your goddamn Jeep?
Believe it or not, he is in the NHRA Hall of Fame.
Is he?
Yeah, my dad, Steve Bagwell, is in the NHRA Hall of Fame for Superstock B Automatic.
I'll be damned. I think I heard you talk about that back in the day. Did that transfer to you? Were you a street racer growing up in high school?
My brothers did. They were definitely into it. I was a little behind them. I went. I loved it. I thought it was fun. I thought it was cool. My dad drag raced. But I didn't have any kind of hot rods or anything like that. But they were definitely into that. And definitely one of them did take it on and do a little drag racing. But, you know, by then, you know, by the time I'd watched and it was time for me, we were almost at the stage of, you know, the company kind of getting in trouble. And it was time to, you know, the fun was kind of coming to an end with the drag racing and the money.
Well, dude, you know, coming up in high school, you were a star baseball player. And what position did you play?
I actually played first base, and I actually was all-county, all-state in football and baseball.
What position you play in football?
I was fullback and quarterback, and I was a big kid. I weighed about 180 pounds as a, you know, back then that was a big kid in the 80s.
It was.
You know? And so, but at the same time, I was a hell of an athlete, so I was also in competition was at the quarterback, but we had a hell of a quarterback too at Sprayberry. So what we did was I went to a school called Sprayberry High School in Cobb County. And so what we did was is we just saw, look, we think it'd be best to get the quarterback that was even with us, even with me, to let him run the quarterback position and let me play fullback. So I played fullback, and then my junior year, opening kickoff, I tore my hamstring off of my pelvis and was out my entire junior year.
Dude, before the injury, what kind of 40 time did you possess?
The best I ever did was about a 4.4.
Come on, dude. You didn't run 4.4.
Now, keep in mind, this is high school and coaches beeping you up and all that.
So that was a 4.6.
I'd say 4.7.
Okay, I'm going with you on this, dude. I played high school football. Go ahead.
A 4.7 is pretty damn good too. So
it is.
I'm going 4.7.
I'm going to go 4.7 too. I mean, goddamn it! I just know my experiences being with you in a ring. I don't think you're capable of running a 4.4.
Because
if you was running a 4.4, every goddamn college in the United States of America would have been recruiting your ass.
Exactly. Not only that, you know, these coaches try to build you up, and you weighed 185, but they said you were.
It's kind of the wrestling protocol.
Yeah, exactly.
So I got to North Texas State, and then we was running our 40s one time, and they called me over, and they said, "What's wrong?" And I said, "What do you mean, what's wrong?" I said, "You're running a 4.9. I said, "Yeah, coach, I always run a 4.9. He said, "Your JUCO coach said you ran a 4.7. I said, "Shit, coach, I ain't never run a 4.7 in my life." So that was I think that was a classic case of your coach padding your stats. But enough with the football. But after high school, obviously no college football for you.
Well, it was absolutely, we played ball to have fun. We were going to work for the company. Southeastern Building Supply was going to be the company we worked for, no doubt about it. And then my senior year, ironically, they went broke. So, you know, Mark Bagwell had to make a decision. So actually, Mark Bagwell, believe it or not, became a massage therapist.
Tell me about that, because, you know, I'm looking at this, you know, I want to talk about your amateur boxing career, and then I want to talk to massage therapist. Well, how in the fuck did you pull that one off?
Well, let's go massage first, and we'll go back to boxing. Massage was...
Was this on the up and up, or predating your gigolo career, which we'll talk about in a minute?
We'll get to that in a minute, but this was a straight-up shoot, you know, total thing. They even tried to clean it up from the word... you know, masseuse to the word massage therapist.
Correct.
And things like that. So, I mean, the Atlanta School of Massage is where I went. It was $10,000 to go. My father had enough money to get each son into something that he would like to try. Well, my oldest brother wanted a gym, so he bought him a gym, a brand new one. My second brother wanted a drywall company. He opened up a drywall company. I'm 18 years old. I don't know what the hell I want to do. So I go out and said, I want something to do with sports, but let me, you know, maybe he's gone over in sports training from this or something, you know. So I went to the massage therapy, and it completely 1,000% backfired on me. Women would walk in and see me and go, hell no. There ain't no way. This motherfucker is going to massage on me. There ain't no way. So it totally went against me. I thought my looks would go for me. I thought me caring about my diet would work for me. It totally went against me, 100%.
I would have never figured you would have failed as a massage therapist because of your looks.
I went to 8 months of school with a college prep anatomy physiology course that I had to fucking legit pass that I didn't want to pass, you know, and I had to pass it to go to graduate this course, brother. And I did so because I was really full bore wanting to try to make something out of my life, and it totally backfired in my face. And that completely, literally, directly transpired into meeting Missy Hyatt.
I'll be damn. Well, hey, hold that thought here, because, dude, I had no knowledge. When you and I were working together back in the days of WCW, Center Stage, all those great memories and all the fun we had. But I didn't know you were an amateur boxer.
When I was younger, my parents, you know, I loved all kind of sports. And we had a friend of ours that we were friends with that was a boxing coach. And the company of the coach that he had was called East Cobb Boxing. And so I got into it and actually became very good at it because I was the youngest of three boys. I was a tough kid. And, I tried it out. I really liked it. Most kids come out, you know, throwing lefts and rights like scared to death. I was sitting there, jab, jab, hook, hook.
Yeah.
And I ended up being very good and ended up winning the Golden Glove State Championship in 1982. Well, in 1983, they went from weight to age. And the difference was, other way around. They went from age to, from weight to age. And what happened was, when it was weight, I could fight pound for pound.
Right.
But when they went age, I was small for my age. So I started getting my brains beat out. But before that, I was 60-1. Newspaper articles, Golden Glove state championship boxer, won the whole thing, and was going to take a year off and come back with my size, and took a year off and went to football and baseball.
This is the Steve Austin Show.
What was your best punch?
To be honest with you, I was so young, Steve, I don't know what my best punch was. I really just believe from my brothers being a younger brother around two older brothers, I just knew how to coordinate a jab, jab, and a hook, and a jab, jab, and a right, and a jab, jab, and a right, you know? And I just believe I fought instead of going out and doing what two little kids do and just throw their lefts and rights, back and forth. And I actually stood back and boxed them and actually just won, because I was a better boxer.
Well, dude, were you a guy that got into a bunch of street fights? Because I never knew you as, like all the boys in the dressing room talk about the quote unquote tough guys,
Oh, yeah.
And those guys are pretty universal. But I never heard of you as a guy that had to settle a scrap or a beef with his hands.
And without any exaggeration, I can remember this almost identical. You were gone about this stage, but I remember knocking a guy out, and there's about 10 wrestlers you can call right now to confirm this, that I knocked a guy out, and you'll know the club because you've been there, in Jacksonville, Florida, and it was called Max's. And we went to that Holiday Inn in Max's in Jacksonville, Florida. And I knocked a guy out there cold as a wedge one night. And as soon as I hit him with one, the guy looked at me, he said, "Hey, if you feel froggy, jump." He didn't get jump out of his mouth. I knocked him out with one punch. And the nasty boys count him out for real, like the 10 count.
Yeah.
From that point on, people looked at me different, like, you know what? This fucking Bagwell kid ain't no little punk kid. This motherfucker may fight you. I went from the prima donna stage to the, this motherfucker just may give you a black eye.
It's interesting the way your skill set with regards to punches translated or transferred to pro wrestling, because Mark Merrill, who came from a boxing background, his punches with disrespect to Mark Merrill, but I mean they were so technical and so quick that they were hard to sell, and you couldn't see them from row 100. But that's because he stuck to that boxer style. So I'm not running him down. I'm just saying you were able to translate or transfer, or you were able to come with that swinging door right and left to open up, which you're not trained to do in boxing, and because those boxing punches, when they're technically efficient, don't translate to our world. You were able to make that transfer.
A shoot jab and a shoot right hook do not look good. A working jab and a working right hook look much better. And I think the reason why for that, Steve, is because I was so young when I was doing it. And when Mark Merrow did it, he was much older, going out for the Olympic team and stuff, would be my answer to that. He was older and had been doing it a lot longer at a much higher scale, so it was much harder for him to learn that work.
It was ingrained in him. That's what it was. But yes. And the reason they don't work, and like I said, I'm not knocking the guy. I'm just saying those things are so quick. It's hard to see a punch like that. It's like the quick hook that Tyson hit Shawn Michaels with back in WrestleMania 14 in Boston. It's like boom. I mean, it happened so fast. It's like about it. But anyway, so dude, what possessed you to jump up and just say, "Hey, man, I'm going to be a pro wrestler"?
What happened was, I went from boxing to my parents in high school and all that, football, baseball, to my parents going broke. And then after my parents went broke, I went to the massage therapy thing. After the massage therapy thing, I'm at the pool one day at where we lived, and I see this blonde hair with big boobs across the pool, and I had no idea what they were talking about, you know, or anything else. And all of a sudden, when I get back to my room, my apartment, the girl is moving in right across the hall from me. And I'm like, that's kind of weird. You know, I don't think nothing about it at all. I'm like, that's kind of strange, you know. So sure enough, that night, knock at the door. My wife was home at the time, my first wife. She's at home with me. We open the door, and Missy comes in and tells the truth. She says, hey, can you guys got a second? We're like, sure. You know, she comes inside, and she says, listen, I saw your husband today at the pool, and I was like, oh, my God, move me in wherever he lives. And so, you know, not having any idea I was married or anything, she's like, move me in to wherever that guy right there lives. Well, the agent didn't know I was married either. So, you know, she told her herself, which made her cool. And she was like, do you guys know me? I'm Missy Hyatt. And we did the same old story you've heard 10,000 times. And that was, well, we watched wrestling as kids, but we don't watch wrestling anymore. Same old thing we've always heard. I actually fucking said. And she said, well, I'm Missy Hyatt, da 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 da. And I said, baby, I said, those guys don't make no damn money. And she goes, well, our lowest paid guy makes about $100,000 a year. And I said, excuse me? And so.
Hello.
Hello. So, you know, my first wife, she was like, hey, you know, God, Mark, you can do anything. You're an athlete. You can do this. So I went out, and a guy named Steve the Brawler Lawler trained me. And I went down into a school, and I came home, and my wife was all excited, and I walked in, and she's all excited, and she goes, how'd it go? And I said, I ain't going back.
What happened?
It was the hardest thing I've ever gone through. I was beat up. This is back in the stage, in the age of, you know, guys didn't smarten nobody up, and I got my brains beat out, and I didn't understand, and I didn't get it, and I took, here's an athlete that didn't know what was going on, and I was like, what in the hell? Well, I told Missy about it, and, you know, she kind of smartened me up a little bit. And then I went down and, you know, watched Kevin and them work a little bit, and they smartened me up a little bit. And then finally, long story short, I for some reason, I went back. And I kept going back to hot dogs and $5 payoffs. And, you know, from there, Handsome Stranger happened and Global. And from there, WCW happened.
So, and that's when you and I crossed paths, because I remember you seeing you on television as a handsome stranger. I said, hey, that's a good-looking dude. You know, I'm a guy. I can see the good-looking dude. I said, I wonder why he's wearing that mask. What was with the mask? And it said that was Bill Eadie's idea.
Of all things, one of the toughest guys in wrestling, yep. Bill Eadie thought of the handsome stranger. And, you know, me, here I am, 19 years old. I just said, yes, sir, no, sir. So I was told that was my gimmick, and I didn't really like it. It wasn't something I wanted to do. But, of course, you know, everybody else is like, why would we cover up the face of the best-looking guy we got? I mean, what are we doing here, you know? So, I mean, what the hell are we doing? So, but, you know, I didn't question that at all. But Bill Eadie came up with it. And from there, you know, we really thought we were going to be, you know, the next big company. And I didn't even know what a big company was back then. This is me hearing the other guys talk. I'm just learning, and I'm 19 years old. And then, you know, it takes deep pockets, as we know, to make it work. And, you know, there was Lightning Kid was there, and Hot Stuff Eddie Gilbert, and, you know, the Ebony Express, which is Harlem Heat, and the Patriot was there. And, you know, there was a lot of talent was there. And, but it just didn't quite pan out. And about that time is when Magnum called me up and gave me a meeting with Dusty, and they signed me to just to go to school, $500 a week thing, and that turned into a contract for life.
All right, but check it out now. Missy Hyatt says, okay, the lowest paid guy on our roster was making about 100 G's. You go into Global, I'm guessing you're making $50 a match. And so
75.
Okay, 75. Sorry to undercut you there. Obviously, it's not the big money you was thinking you was going to make. At 19 years of age, a very impressionable guy, what were your thoughts on the business back in the days when they finally smartened you up? You're making 75 a match, which, you know, is actually pretty good money for back in that day for someone just learning. But what was your mindset in that locker room? Because you got a bunch of badasses, and because there were some other veterans still in that locker room as well.
absolute phenomenal question. And let me tell you what saved my life. What saved my life with that, Steve, was Missy Hyatt. She told me from jump, she said, you are not to give a shit about what you're getting paid. You are to shake every hand you see. You are to be the Marv Bagley you are to me, which is nice and polite to everybody. And you are to do what you're supposed to do. This is, and she kind of explained the business, how it works, and being nice, which fit up my alley because I was a nice guy genuinely anyway. But she explained it to me how it works. And you know, here comes this prima donna coming in and shaking everybody's hands, and everybody's wanting to hate me, but they couldn't because I was doing everything right. And I was shaking the hands and thanking everybody and sitting in the right seat and keeping my mouth shut and doing what I was supposed to do because, thank God, Missy Hyatt told me. So to answer your question, what I was thinking was exactly what Missy Hyatt got me ready for, which was, you're not here to make money right now. You are here to learn.
Yep.
So don't worry about the money. Don't worry about it. If it had been the money and all that, Steve, I would have never made it. I would have thought, this is ridiculous, it's not going to pan out, I'd have gone to something else. But I listened to what Missy had to say, and I stuck to it, and what she had to say is exactly how it panned out.
You know, and it's a good thing that she, first of all, noticed you, took you under her wing, and smartened you up with a lot of valuable 411, because she had been around the business for quite some time, and she was around, you know, the upper end brains. And she was a veteran. And I mean, dude, people don't understand, you know, when she was down there at Mid-South, UWF, Power Pro, whatever you want to call it, the loaded Gucci bag, the feud with Dark Journey. I mean, she was over. And, you know, hanging out with the Eddie Gilberts and the Bill Watts. I mean, the young lady, she's about my age, but, you know, and I've always been a Missy fan. But she was pretty damn smart with regards to the business.
Everything she told me, Steve, and I've always put her over in every interview, and it's in her book, everything she told me is exactly the reason why I had a good career in this business, and that was because I listened to what she told me. It was the right information. If it had been the wrong information, I was screwed. It was lucky enough that somebody that was telling me the right information knew what they were talking about. It was the right information, and it was told to the right person that was going to deliver it the right way. And I did so, and it came out great.
Hey, before we shift to your WCW days, going back to Global, how many days a week were you guys running? If you're making 75 a match, what are you bringing in a week? Are you solely surviving on wrestling money, or are you doing jobs on the side?
Oh, absolutely not. I was stripping at the place called the Lemon Peel.
Talk to me about this stripping.
There was this place called the Lemon Peel off Buford Highway in Atlanta, and it was this only place you could go. Back in the day, it was the only place you could go for girls to go to their bachelorette parties. It was the only one. And so we had one. It was called the Lemon Peel. And you could get up. You could get in from 18 up, but you couldn't drink. But you could get in from 18 and up. And, you know, the 21 year up could drink, but the 18 and up couldn't. But it was slammed every night of the week because it was the only place to go for these girls to have bachelorette parties. So we just, I probably made, you know, $300 to $500 to $700 extra dollars a week during that. And I went directly from that to the Handsome Stranger. And from the Handsome Stranger, you know, is when WCW found me.
Now tell me about the Lemon Peel thing again, because the world of professional wrestling, with respect to everything that goes on the roads, is enough and is one thing. Now all of a sudden you're over there working at the Lemon Peel as a stripper. I mean, women galore. So how did that balance out, dude? Because you go from one thing, which is, you know, there's a lot of women out there, and you go to another thing, there's a lot of women out there. I mean, obviously,
it kind of was very smooth, Steve. To believe it or not, it was. It kind of filled the void, and all the boys knew I was trying to make it into wrestling. And I remember sitting in the locker room and watching me on ESPN as the Handsome Stranger, and all the guys were like, you know, you're going to make it, man. You're going to make it. I'm like, well, I hope. You know, I don't know. You know, so it really was something that really helped me out. And, of course, you know how wives can be. My first wife was like, you know, you got to get a job. What the hell's going on? You know, this damn wrestling shit ain't bringing no money in. I don't get it. You know, and I got, baby, just give me a year. I can make it. And, of course, once I made it, then it was like, I knew you had it in you. You're the best. I ain't got to strip no more. You know, she was stripping, too. So for us to make an income, we both were stripping and just making an income to get me into pro wrestling.
Dude, what happened to your first marriage? Because I remember meeting your first wife way back in the day, and I can't remember. But it probably had to have been around 92, 93.
Absolutely. We got divorced in 94, so you're right on the money. We were married from 90 to 94. Still great friends with her. She's still a great girl and all that. It just came down to, you know, we had no idea I was going to get into wrestling. And the last thing she wanted was to have a relationship with somebody that traveled those kind of hours and days on the road and just wasn't ready for that. But what really happened was, as me being 20 years old, Steve, is I cheated on her. And at 20 years old, when I cheated on her, I told her. I was honest and told her the truth. I did the honest route, and it did nothing but completely backfire on me, and I tried my best to make it right, and it came down to one day. I looked at her, and I said, baby, I said, I'm going to ask you a question, and I said, I'm going to give you 2 minutes to answer this question, so I want you to listen to me real close. And she said, no problem. And I said, it's been about a year. And there ain't no cell phones and stuff back then. And I said, so it's been about a year. I've sent you to Vegas. I've sent you to Jamaica with your sister. I said, trying to make up for it. I feel like I paid my time. If you can't forgive me in the next 2 minutes, I'm going to go outside. I'm going to get in the Corvette. I'm going to crank it up. And I'm going to go to the first lawyer I got. And I'm getting a divorce. And believe it or not, she took about a minute 50. I swear to God she did. She really took her time. I was proud of her.
Yeah.
And at a minute 50, she said, I can't forgive you.
God damn.
I put my shoes on. I cranked the car. I went and got divorced, and it was over.
Boy, I tell you what, that's interesting.
Yeah. And I really tried to make it work. I paid my dues. I told the truth. You know, I called her at every – I got dogged out by all the boys by stopping every payphone and really tried to do the right thing. And she just – I even told her, I said, baby, it ain't greener on the other side. You got to hang in there. And to this day, she's single, wishes she would have listened to me. And God bless her, she didn't. And now she's still a single mom and a great girl, but – by herself, and she's got a beautiful daughter, but she's a single mom.
Hey, man, the business can be tough on relationships. Hey, but you handled it up front. You did the best you could. And obviously, man, she didn't want a man on the road, and she couldn't forgive you. So respect to her for that. But, hey, I'm going to take a quick break here with Marcus Buff Bagwell. This thing is about to heat up. We're going 2,500 RPMs. We're going to hit 6,000 before this conversation is over. We're going to get some of the trials and tribulations that Mark went through in his journey. We ain't going to chronicle everything he did in the business, but we're going to talk about some of the highlights that you will see on the documentary. Buff the Stuff. What's it called, Mark?
It is called The Good, The Bad, and The Buff. The Mark Bagwell Journey.
This is the Steve Austin Show.
All right, I'm sitting here back with Buff Bagwell. Appreciate you guys tuning in for my sponsors. I just want to allow me to open up two cans of Audio Whoop Ass for Your Ass free each and every single week. And we're about to get into a big can with Marcus Bagwell right now. Dude, when you roll into WCW, I cannot remember the first time we met. I just remember liking you and having a good time. I just thought you was one of the funniest guys I'd ever met in the business, a guy that tells a hell of a story. So some of the stories that Mark and I will tell here on the podcast, when he comes out with this docu-shoot, this documentary is coming out with, you know, I would encourage you to buy the thing just to watch the sumbitch tell the damn stories, because hearing him is one thing, being able to see him while he's telling them is a whole different ball game. So anyway, back to you, Mark. You rolled into WCW. Yeah. Where did we first meet?
Well, we really first bonded met was me and Nash one night. We did that there wasn't a sip of alcohol, nothing done all night long. We sat there talking all night till the sun came up. And all of a sudden, I had told him a story about me having an altercation with my father, And he, before I knew it, he started calling. Wrestler was at the Admiral Benbow, or Benbow. In Jacksonville, Florida. And he started calling down wrestlers. And the first one he called, I remember, was Dallas Page. And so I had to tell that story. I had to tell it about 10 times. And I can tell you, that was the first time I saw you look at me with a little bit of like, you know what, I like this kid. And that was the first time I felt like we truly met. And so, but that was the time where I told the story, and, you know, and when I told it, everybody just knew by the way I told it, you couldn't make this damn story up. And it was just too good to be made up. And it was just like, are you shitting me? You shot your father and what? So from that point on, everybody's like, I'm just not sure I'd take this kid. Here's this pretty boy that's been in jail more than all of us, and now he shot his fucking father. So what the hell is going on? What are we missing?
Now, you going to cover this story on the docu-shoot or what?
Oh, dude, I go in detail, and my old man actually talks, too, about it in the documentary, and he does his spiel. And the good thing about my documentary, Steve, it is really, we go into the depths of hell. But with my documentary, it comes out with a great ending. I mean, you know, I survived. I made it. I'm still in shape. I still feel good. I survived, you know, where I shouldn't have. I dodged the drugs, and I didn't dodge them, but I survived them and conquered them in the long run. I ended up being sober, having my life totally turned around, and the documentary ends up, you know, a great positive ending instead of ending where you're, you know, wanting to slice your wrist.
So we're going to leave the you shooting your dad story off this podcast, but it is in the documentary, so you got to check out this story. It is crazy as fuck. But let me ask you something. Now, as we speak, the documentary is going to come out in, what, 1 to 2 days. There's no heat between you and your dad.
Absolutely not. We're as tight as we've ever been, and that's what I was talking about, how weird it is on the depths and craziness my life went into, and then me and my father are as tight as you ever could imagine, you know. But we actually started talking a little bit before we did this with you today and started thinking about what we could talk about, you know, to kind of cut loose a little bit. And it's something that may make you a little uncomfortable, but, you know, it's the Jim Ross part of the story of the documentary.
No, you're not going to make me uncomfortable at all, because I read that there was some heat between you guys. What had happened?
Well, this is where I wanted to cut loose and be myself, and I was able to do so and be able to tell a good full story about the documentary and not, you know, leave people guessing on one of them. And this is one of those ones I wanted to get out there and really hear my voice and fill my heart with this one, because it's one of the biggest ones of all that I feel the most, you know, really, really, you know, hurt from. And just between me and you, Steve, I am 100% convinced, whether I'm right or wrong, that Jim Ross ruined my career. And how that came down, unfortunately, is there's only three witnesses, and it's Jim, God, and me. But I was sitting home one day, and what had happened was we were down at wrestling school at WWF at the time, and we were learning the ring ropes and all that, the 20-foot ring and all that stuff. And I got an argument with Shane Helms, and I ended up slapping him. And after I slapped him and I turned around to walk off, he hits me with an ice bottle that was frozen that opened up my head 20 stitches deep. And all the wrestlers, keep in mind, at that stage, there were 12 WCW guys hired. And at the 12 being hired, you know, everybody back then thought for sure Buff Bagwell's got a job. He's got a job. He's, you know, we're just trying to make it. He's got a job. Now, I hoped and wished, but that's how everybody else looked at it. Well, here is Shane Helms holding the rag on my head, crying, telling me he's sorry. And the wrestlers actually convinced me, with cell phones out, that to lie and say that I fell. And I said, guys, y'all know there's no way this is going to stay hidden. There's no way. Well, I do what the wrestlers asked me. And I said I fell to, I'll never forget it, it was to Finley, Fit Finley, and Laurinaitis. And I said we fell. I said, I fell. I slipped and hit my head. And they knew I was lying, but they didn't know. They didn't see it, so they didn't know what had happened. And so I just went ahead with it. And, you know, I flew straight home, got my – I didn't ask for WWF. I didn't ask them to – fix my head or go to their doctor. I did my own money, my own insurance to keep the heat down from everything. And all of a sudden I came back to, to Raw the following Monday. And when I showed up, after being told everything I was told and Shane Helms crying and everything, I see Shane Helms and the Hardy Boys coming at me. And I said hello to them, and none of them waved and none of them said hello. And as soon as I saw that, I went straight to Laurinaitis. And I said, brother, here's the deal. And I told him the whole story. I said, here's what happened. Here's what's going on. Well, he got all 12 guys together, made us all apologize, shake hands. Because at this stage, he's trying to have a job.
Right.
You know, he's got 12 guys. He's got to get over to, you know, WWF. So we all shook hands and did the whole thing and got everything together. And... so we go out and have the match, and from there, you know, we just really thought that, you know, everything was going to be okay. And then, you know, once the match happened with everything, Jim Ross, after the match happened, you know, it was a bad match. We kind of stumbled over each other. We didn't have a good match. And me and Booker's had 10,000 barn burners. We actually had a kind of a bad match. And that night, believe it or not, WWF took the blame. They said, you know what? It's our fault. Pat does the main events, and we thought he was going to talk to you guys. And Johnny Laurinaitis has you guys, so we thought he was going to talk to you. Nobody talked to you guys. So y'all did the best you could. Don't worry about it. Let it go. The next week was Atlanta, Georgia. So on Friday, Jim Ross, God, and me are on the phone, and Jim Ross says, hey, buddy, just want you to know, I want you to take the weekend off, which was Augusta and Birmingham, and then Atlanta, the Dome. And he said, take the weekend off, let your head heal. We got big plans for you at Phillips Arena on Monday in Atlanta. So I was like, thank you so much, Jim. I really appreciate it. Well, the story got out, and it stuck like glue that my mother had called to get me out of those shows. Now, why in the hell would I cancel two shows after already working with stitches in my head when I had two drives when I'm trying to fit into the WWF 2 weeks being there? I'm kissing ass. I'm walking on eggshells. I'm shaking hands. I'm kissing babies. I'm trying to get in WWF and do it right. And so somehow or another, though, the mother story to this day sticks like glue. And so we go out and do the whole deal. I show up, get to the building, and they fire me. And I didn't even know they were, I had to raise my hand. And when they get me in the room, I raise my hand. And Vince goes, you don't got to raise your hand, Mark. I said, well, I feel like I do. I go, it sounds like y'all are firing me. And Vince goes, oh no, we're not firing you. He said, we're releasing you. And I raised my hand again. And he goes, Mark, I already said you ain't got to raise your hand. I said, but what's the difference in firing and raising? I mean, and releasing. And he said, and the son of a bitch had an answer. He said, well, if we fire you, we got to redo your contract. He said, and if we release you, we can bring you back in 3 months and no problems, and you just start back up with us. And so at that stage, I knew they were full of shit, God bless them, but I also knew to start smiling, shaking hands, and just leave. And I did so. I started shaking hands, kissing babies, and realized it was just best to, you know, get out of there. And I got in my car, bawled and crying, and I called up, you know, my parents that were in the stands, and I said, you know, it's time for you guys to come on home. And they were like, what do you mean? I go, I'm home. It's over.
I'm not in the building anymore.
Yeah, I'm not in the building there, so y'all can come home too.
So are you maintaining in that Jim Ross set you up? Did your mother ever make those phone calls?
Absolutely not. Mother never made those phone calls. And I even went the route, like anybody else would. I even went the route, okay, let's go the route that my mom slipped up and made the phone calls. Now let's go this route. Why would you do the invasion of Booker T and Buff Bagwell in Tacoma, Washington, when the next week you're in Phillips Arena? Why wouldn't you just wait a week and put Buff Bagwell versus Booker T at the Phillips Arena in Ted Turner's backyard? So, to me, it all made sense. We knew, even up in Tacoma, why are we wrestling when next week's Atlanta? But to me, it all kind of made sense. But I, you know, let's be truthful to each other. Did my mom make the calls? Could she have? Absolutely. Do I think she did? Absolutely not. But I really believe with all my heart that, you know, that Jim Ross really, really, really took his time out and even took time on the round table with all the legends and took his time out to bury me and say that, you know, I showed up at these shows. And I just don't know where that hatred come from for him to want to take that much time out to really. And I'm talking about, you know how Jim was. He loved football players and athletes. We talked every week when he was at WCW about.
But did he bury you to the higher ups?
I don't know. I really don't know what happened. I just know that, and I did what they told me to do. They said in 3 months, call us back. And I waited about 2 weeks past the 3 months. And so it wasn't right at 3 months. And when I called Jim Ross, he literally answered the phone with a deep breath. And I swear to God, I went, Jim, I'm just calling back because you told me to. I said, and he said, and he didn't call me Bub. He went, yeah, Mark. I said, Jim, I'm just calling you back because you guys told me to call you in 3 months. I waited 2 weeks longer than that, and I'm just calling you back. And he said, Mark, we'll call you if we need you. And hung the phone up on me.
Cut and dry, that's all.
Cut and dry, and that was it, brother.
You know, let's go back to that match that happened. You said Tacoma, Washington. I went back and watched that match last night on YouTube, and it wasn't so fact that the match was a bad match. Was it a great match? No, it was mechanically was what it was. It was a hostile environment. That was a WWF crowd, dude, and all of a sudden they put in WCW guys, and man, look at Booker T's career. Look at your career speaks for itself. It was a hostile crowd. Again, the match wasn't the greatest, but it wasn't the god-awful stinker that people have made it out to be. And when I say hostile crowd, I'm not running down that audience. I just meant, you know how it was, dude. Back then, you were either WWF or you were WCW. So you guys were, it was like playing an away game. You guys were having an away game in WWF territory, and people didn't give a shit about you guys. And that was my take on that, dude.
Absolutely. And think about this. If you really play it back and watch it, Stacy Keibler was the announcer. She
yep.
got booed out of the building. Shane McMahon comes down, gets booed out of the building. Arn Anderson and the other announcer comes down, gets booed out of the building.
Yep.
And here we come. Booker goes first. He comes down, gets booed out of the building. And I swear to God, back to me thinking something else was up with it. I just believe it with my heart. My music comes on, and I swear to God, I took the step to walk out, and Shane McMahon steps in front of me and goes, oh, yeah, I forgot to tell you, don't look in the cameras. And I said, have you ever watched one of my matches? That's all I fucking do. I said, the only thing I fucking do is pose and look in the cameras.
That's the gimmick.
I said, that's my whole gimmick. So if you watch it back, Yeah. I'll walk down that aisle and act like the fucking TV camera's got the plague. I'm trying to get away from it. I'm dodging the camera. I'm looking away from it. I can't look in the camera. I'm like, oh, my God, I can't look in the camera. So, oh, my God. So I was totally I'm getting booed and shit thrown at me. I'm like, what the fuck's going on? I'm getting booed for the first time. It was brutal, Steve.
Well, dude, you talk about your own pins and needles to begin with. You're in a foreign territory. You got a hostile crowd. And then all of a sudden, right before you fucking go out, someone gives you the 411 of, oh, yeah, by the way, don't do this. It'd be like someone telling me, hey, dude, don't stomp anybody and don't flip anybody off and don't even look like you're cussing because you're hamstringing me and you're handcuffing me before I even, especially if you tell me that shit right before I go out, because then you're really fucking with my head.
And once again, Steve, these are things that people just got to believe, but I swear to God that's the truth. And I just keep in mind, all you got to do is watch the match back, and it'll be the only match you've ever seen me not come down the ramp and talking to the camera. I literally am dodging that camera every angle I can get away from it. I'm trying to run from the camera like it's got a gun on me. And I mean, I'm literally trying to dodge it like there's an automatic weapon behind it. And I'm like, what the fuck? Why do they do this to me, you know? And the whole time I'm thinking, why in the hell wouldn't we just do this in Atlanta, you know? So to be honest with you, me and Booker were at least smart enough to know backstage before the match started, something had to be a little bit up. They knew we didn't. For them to even want to throw this together and put this square peg in a round hole in Tacoma, Washington, where all you had to do was wait 7 fucking days and put a round peg in a round hole, and everybody loved it.
What do you think when you roll into the WWF scene? Because, dude, I mean, again, we're coming out of the business is work, but the wars were shoot. I mean, we were after y'all's ass, y'all were after ours, and y'all had been kicking our ass for a long time. So what the fuck did you feel like when you walked in that locker room? Because, again, the boys are the boys, and you know some of them. But, again, it's damn near shoot. You're a scab.
Well, to be totally honest with you, Steve, I'm going to be totally, totally, totally honest. I really thought, and I think it's because of my age, I really thought I was going to walk in to handshakes and hugging and what's going on. And it didn't take me long because I'm a smart boy, but I still thought that's how it was going to be at first. But then when it didn't happen, I realized, I said, wait a second. I said, I'm their fucking enemy. I'm here to take their, if I get a job, that's taking one of their jobs away. So I found out very quickly why I wasn't getting, taken in. But at the same time, I wasn't ready for it, Steve. I just really wasn't, with just the friends I had and nobody really talking to me. And just, I mean, I got to tell this one story because it's so great. But I swear to God, the first day I was there, I went in and got my stuff laid out. And I was in the fucking A locker room and didn't want to be. I end up in the A locker room, and it's the last place in the world I want to be. And I'm sitting there, but I ain't about to move my shit out of there. Now that looks stupid. So I'm thinking, well, I got to ride it out. So I'm sitting there, and I get my little hat out, and I get my little shit ready, and my little diet coat.
And that's heat.
Oh, just tons of it. I'm trying to hide the hot stuff because that's heat, too. And I can't. I'm going to use it no matter what. But I'm trying to hide the heat in the meanwhile, and fucking trying to get all that hid. And then all of a sudden, I get up to go get something to drink. When I come back, my top hat's squished in. If I had to bet, you were one of the three that did it.
Oh no, I didn't squash your hat. I would never ever do that to. I wouldn't remember.
Well, for starters, understand if I say that, I fucking love it because listen to the finish. I mean, I would think it was great that you did that because I thought it was great when it happened. I'm a boy in the business, a young kid in the business that fucking understands it, and that was beautiful. So I come back, and I even kind of giggle. I go, that's fucking great. That's fucking great. My hat's still crushed in, you know. So I fix my little hat. I get it all propped back up just right, everything. So about 30 minutes later, something to drink. I go to get something to drink, come back. My hat's crushed in again. And I was like, damn. And you know me, I didn't get mad or anything. You don't, you know, you're always told not to sell it, not to
sell
it.
Right, right.
So I come back. I fix my little hat again, you know, get it all ready, and didn't sell. I heard a few giggles in the background, and just get my little hat ready. Well, about 30 minutes later, I need something else to drink or something. Well, I get up to go walk out, and it hits me. So I go back, and I just crush my own fucking hat in. I swear to God I do. And I'm walking out laughing, thinking, now what are these motherfuckers going to do with that? And I'm laughing. I go get my drink. I come back, and guess what?
What?
It was fixed. It was fucking fixed. And it was perfect. I mean, the wrinkles were even out of it. It was like they ironed it. It was perfect.
It was a reverse rib.
Reverse ribs. I said, I can't win. These motherfuckers are on another level than me. They're Dude, better than me.
I give you my word. I had zero to do with that. Here's the thing. Well, first of all, I want to talk about the match, but I also want to talk about the Icy Hot. What that was, when Buff's talking about that, it was a vasodilator that a lot of the bodybuilding guys, which you were in that clique, a lot of the bodybuilding guys, body guys, would rub on them, and it was called...
Hey, and Steve, before you continue, talk about all WCW guys did it.
Oh, yeah. So what it was, you rubbed it on, it made you shiny, but it brought all your veins to the surface, so if you was a physique guy, it made you look good as fuck. But, you know, when you were working with a guy that had that shit on, man, if it got in your eyes or it got on you, because it was called hot stuff. It was hot. And so I always hated working with you guys that wore that fucking stuff because it was Everybody, a pain in the ass.
And it would blow you up.
Oh, would it? Yeah, but it sucked ass because it'd get in your eyes. It looked good on TV, but it was a pain in the ass to work with.
Well, during this time, if you remember, WWF outlawed it.
Oh, I can't even remember that.
They said no more. And this was during the time you were there because Booker hadn't done his first angle with you. Booker's first angle, the very first angle of WCW and WWF was Booker T came out and threw you through that table and he missed you and hurt your elbow. Do you remember that?
No. I broke three bones in my back. But when I watch that back, yeah, the way I skipped off, because I watched an interview of him on Off the Record with Michael Landis, and he was correct. He put me through the table. I mean, well, he put me on it because I was so sweaty. I glanced off, and when I glanced off, I hit the table and bounced onto the chair, and the chair was what broke the three bones. So it was Booker T that put the move on me, but the way I skipped off the table, that was not his fault. Right. But at the time, I thought it was his fault, but it was not. It was skipping across that table like a stone on water onto that chair.
Absolutely. But if you remember, he got the heat for it, though.
He did get heat for it. But here's the thing. When I was so many times when I try to remember different parts of my career, I forget a lot of stuff. Here's the thing that I forgot. I was watching that match that you guys were having in Tacoma, y'all's first match in the WWF on Monday Night Raw. I didn't even remember that Kurt Angle and I did a run-in and interrupted the match. So I'm watching this fucking match. I'm thinking, what the fuck am I doing out there? And so we beat the shit out of Booker T and walked up the ramp, and you joined in. So I don't even remember that happening.
Well, here's what I don't remember. I thought, until I watched it back, I thought you threw us both out right away. But the storyline was they wanted to make it. We beat Booker. All three of us beat Booker up the whole way to the back.
Correct.
And then when y'all threw Booker out, I did my little Buff character like, hey, we got him. We still got that motherfucker. Yeah, all right, you know. And then y'all was each other like, hey, let's throw him out too. And it got a big pop because y'all threw me out too, and WCW was out, and WWF was in, and it made sense and all that. But, yeah, so, yeah, at first it was supposed to be just Booker out, you know, but they wanted to throw that little extra thing in there of, you know, hey, let's let Buff act like, you know, he's part of it, and then let's screw him too and throw him out also, you know. So, you know, from that point, like I said, I thought when Jim Ross called me, which was the next thing that happened, I really thought he meant it. I thought, hey, here we go. I'm main event on Raw, which I don't know why I was and didn't understand why, but I was. And then I thought, well, maybe they do got some better plans for me on Monday night at this next Raw in Atlanta. Little did I know those plans were you're fired, but I didn't know that. And like I said, back to that, Steve, you don't fire a Buff Bagwell over one bad match, do you? I mean, don't you warn him? Don't you say don't do that? Don't you?
Well, I mean, first of all, you don't fire a guy over a bad match, especially on his first night in. I mean, you give him a fighting chance. I mean, because anybody can have a bad match.
Especially with 10 years I've gave him of good matches and stuff. And, give me a warning. Give me a, hey, we don't do it that way here.
Had he transcended from WCW? Well, could that have been part of it?
That's absolutely what happened, Steve. The heat had transpired, and I couldn't fix it. And this is what I'm getting ready to tell you that nobody knows. You've never heard it. Nobody knows this, and this is 100% facts. So listen close. So what we came up with was here I am, Buff Bagwell, contract's up in June, and I ain't got the exact months correctly, but let me go ahead and just tell you, whenever my contract was up, I had a few months left when WWF bought our company. So I came up with the idea. I said, look, I called my agent. I said, I can sit at home for 2 months and get paid. I said, or I can hand Vince $120,000 or $30,000 for the 2 months and act like I'm a team player, save Vince $120,000 and say, here I am, I'm a team player, and let all that erase the heat, the internet, and let's erase and start over. And my agent thought it was the most brilliant thing in the world. He said, let's do that. That's brilliant. That's great. So I called Vince up. I said, Vince, here's what I want to do. I said, I don't want to sit at home. I want to go to work directly. He said, we can't, Mark, we owe you that money. That I said, you know what, Vince? I don't want the money. Let's just cancel the money. I want to show you that as I'm a team player. So let's just forget the $120,000. Let's move on. That's my way of showing I'm a team player. And that's my way of wiping anything slate that you've heard, letting all the rumors get past that's a person that's just said, hey, let's do the right thing. And I was fired in 2 weeks.
Well, I heard that interview on AIW when you were talking with a guy at one of the indie shows, and it was about $80,000 at that time. But regardless, whatever the money was, given the situation now, knowing what you know now, what would you have done? Jump on board and say, pay me out, then bring me on? What?
I swear to God, Mark Bagwell would have still think the best route would be, as much heat as I had, Steve, the only play I had was to show Vince I'm a team player, save him money, and show him I'm a team player. I would have still done the same thing, I swear.
Man, let's talk about heat for just a second, because back when you first came into WCW, you teamed up with various guys, sometimes the Patriots, sometimes Scotty Riggs, sometimes Tom Zink, but you formed a tag team with Too Cold Scorpio, Brian Pillman, Flying Brian, and I, as the Hollywood Blondes, used to wrestle you guys all over South Georgia.
A bunch of times, brother.
Everywhere, and we had a goddamn blast. And we loved working with you guys. And then so I always thought that you guys were really good friends. And then all of a sudden, I get the scuttlebutt. But that I guess now you guys are mortal enemies. Where's the heat between you and Too Cold? And how did that happen?
Wow. You talking about wow, bro. I'm sitting home one day. Kevin calls me up, my manager, Kevin Ballou, and he goes, brother, go look at this website. He shows me this thing where Too Cold Scorpio is talking to me like an absolute dog. I mean, I'm talking about I was blown away. I never seen nothing like it. Here's a guy that I spent 3 to 4 years with, tag team of the year, two-time world tag team champions, doing things back then that was unheard of, now or nothing, but Hardy Boy type stuff before the Hardy Boys were doing it. Just really, we were the tag team of the year, brother, in 92. That's a big damn deal, and we're doing the right thing and we're doing everything good. And I swear to God, bro, all of a sudden, here I go see, I see him in New York at a house show, and we hit it off. And we have a great match, and we tagged against these guys and had a good time. And I even handed him a DVD I had made of us, because I did five series of my career, and one of them was him. And I did all our best matches and blah, blah, blah. And when I did the I gave the DVD, we hugged and took pictures and everything. Everything was cool. And then I get home, and Kevin tells me, look at this video. And, brother, it is him completely, like, beyond belief, like fighting mad, you know, dog cussing me, saying things like, you know, like have you ever seen Rocky III, where, you know, Mr. T was dogging out Rocky in the crowd saying, hey, woman, won't you come over and let me show you what a real man's like tonight? I mean, it was kind of like that kind of interview. I mean, it was like him going personal and sexual and doing things that I just couldn't believe, you know, and I just couldn't believe it. And so it ended up being about a shoot story. It was a shoot story, you know, on, you know, us having a plane ticket overseas. And I asked him to move under whatever situation. I don't remember what it was over, but it was something to do with me and my wife sitting together and all that. And me, of course, you know me, Steve, me thanking him and paying him back in some shape, form, or fashion. I don't know the details, but it wasn't something that it was ugly. I was always very well-mannered and thank you, and no, sir, yes, sir, and all that. And, you know, so it was one of those very nice things. But, brother, it was beyond belief bad. So in my interview, in my docu-shoot, I go off and they have to literally show his interview so it makes sense. But I reply to his interview, and it's extremely well. Matter of fact, it's the reason why this is rated R.
Okay, so the reply is on the docu-shoot.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so we won't get into that now, but since the docu-shoot, since your reply, have you guys been able to bury the hatchet? Obviously, he hasn't seen it. Have you seen each other in person?
I haven't heard a word about it. He hasn't seen it in person. I've not seen him in person. He hasn't seen it. Nothing like that, but he's going to see it. So it definitely is, you know, going to be, you know, and it, like I said, we had to show his footage so people understood what I was talking about. That's how weird it is. You know, we had to show his footage so people understood why I was so mad about. But I go off and I was genuinely mad and answer his rebuttal of how stupid he was. And if he was that mad, let's be logical about this. Why didn't you come to me and talk to me about it? You know, you dumbass. Why didn't you come to me and talk to me?
Well, do you have time to stick around for another hour, Mark?
Oh, hell yeah.
Okay, what we're going to do is we're going to end the podcast on this note. We're going to come back, and I want to talk about broken necks. You've had two of them. I want to talk about your run and your introduction to the wild side and the fast side of living in the business of professional wrestling, because you got caught up in a grind, and I know you're going to share a lot of this stuff in a docu-shoot. It's the good, the bad, and the buff. It's the Mark Bagwell journey, and it's coming out on a docu-shoot on DVD, and this thing is going to drop when, Mark?
Halloween.
Going to drop on Halloween, just literally 2 days after this podcast airs. And you can find Mark on Twitter. Mark, what's your Twitter account?
It is Real Buff Bagwell. You can go to Twitter and my Facebook, realbuffbagwell.com.
And talk about your website.
And, brother, I'm telling you, we're real excited about it. It's tremendous. And that's why we made it easy, Steve, is because this is very hard for me at first. And so Kevin did a great job, my manager, of making it easy for everybody. And it's real simple. You go to realbuffbagwell.com. And from there, you can Twitter me. You can tweet me. You can Facebook me. You can do anything you want to my website. So go to the realbuffbagwell.com.
All right, I'm coming back next week with part two of my conversation with Buff Bagwell, and we'll get into some broken necks and to some living fast, because I've been there and I've done both of them. Coming back. Thank you, Mark. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, brother.
This has been a Podcast One production. Download new episodes of The Steve Austin Show every Tuesday at PodcastOne.com. That's PodcastOne.com.
Hey, Friday Night Lights fans. It's Not Only Football, Friday Night Lights and Beyond is an episode-by-episode discussion of the hit TV series Friday Night Lights, hosted by yours truly, Scott Porter, who played Jason Street on the show, and my two wonderful co-hosts.
Me, Zach Guilford, a.k.a. Matt Saracen.
And me, Mae Whitman, a.k.a. someone who wasn't on the show, but really, really loves it a lot.
We will also bring on some special guests, answer your questions, and tell you about what's going on in our lives today.
It's Not Only Football, Friday Night Lights and Beyond is available now wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Clear eyes, full hearts, can't lose!
Yo, what's good? It's your boy, Big Brother Jake, a.k.a. Jake Warner.
My government name.
Check it out. I host a show called the Big Brother Jake Podcast, and I've taken my talents to the biggest and baddest platform on the planet. That's right, baby. Podcast One. My show is unique as I talk about everything. Life, sports, entertainment, being a single dad juggling several jobs. I'm a hot mess, but it's damn entertaining. Subscribe and review now on Apple Podcasts and listen on Podcast One or wherever you get your podcasts.